I wanted very much to come to the Middle East. So in those days, and probably now, there are only two real ways of doing it, either as a teacher or as a journalist. So basically, I had one article to my name, but I wrote to the Daily Star here, for example, and various other publications around the world, saying, I'm a journalist, I'm going to be in Beirut. And they kind of believed me. Anyway, so long and short is, I was living in Wales in the countryside at the time. I stuffed as much as I could into my little Renault 4. And just after Christmas 1974, I jumped into my car and drove out here in the middle of winter. Arrived here on a Saturday morning in the Burj. I didn't know, you know, driving into Beirut from the north, I was seeing signs like Sinl Feel. And that didn't mean anything to me at all. You know, elephant tusk, what's that? So I just sort of stopped. And as it happened, I parked behind the cinema at the bottom of the Burj, you know, Sahad Shuhada, Martyr Square. And it was Saturday morning, and the place was just exploding with noise. In those days, that was all markets down there, the souks. And that was my first sort of experience of Beirut, and it was mind-blowing, because the place in those days was a kind of organic market that you felt had real roots, and everybody's shouting, and there's colors and smells and noise, and you know, it was just mind-blowing. Got back to my car. I had a parking ticket, my first and only parking ticket. I wish I'd kept it, because probably they stopped doing that during the war, which came along just a few months later.
Lebanon was something kind of mysterious. It never appeared in the press before the Civil War.
There was an appetite for stories out of Lebanon. It became a very, very demanding story that had to be covered almost around the clock.
You covered a story every day. So somehow all the stories blend into each other. They all blend into covering a war.
Everybody rushing, who is going to break the news first?
I covered the story as a professional journalist.
They used to send us to cover big story.
As long as I could write about it, I felt okay.
We always strive to be there as it's happening and to be at the front of the front line.
I put my life on hold. My life was the story.
So I had passion, actually. If you don't like it, you cannot do it.
The thing about photography that's different is, you have to be there while it happens. You can't arrive a minute later and have people tell you about it.
We honestly believed that the story needed to come out.
We only need to listen, see.
So you had to interview, you had to visit, you had to experience, witness, feel, and then kind of synthesize and process and reproduce.
My job as a photographer, as a journalist, is just to be a fair recorder of what happened and let other people sort it out. Just create that record.
Be it as a journalist, be it as a citizen, each one believed firmly that their salvation was in digging in your heels, even if it cost your life.
My biggest fear as a reporter, but also as a Lebanese, was that this misery would be forgotten.
If I don't record this, then it will, you know, just be forgotten.
If I start reading my notebook, I'll be there forever. I hope the ink hasn't faded, because sometimes ink fades. I think they've become so faint over time. You know, talking 40 years.
I was exposed to journalism, and I said, let's try it. And I was so passionate about it that I climbed the ladder quite quickly. The environment of journalism at the time, it was really challenging, and this is what I liked about it. I started with the Middle East Reporter newsletter. Then I was offered a job with the United Press International, which is an American news agency. And this is when I started really going on the field and reporting.
My friends who were Italian or who were Irish, they sort of had, you know, memories of their ancestral homelands, and it was in popular media all the time. Lebanon, nothing. It never appeared in the press before the Civil War. And the images that were coming across through the news media were so at odds with this sort of like idyllic place my family talked about that it was hard to reconcile it, you know? So that's what piqued my curiosity. I thought, There's no news reporting coming out of Lebanon or coming from the Palestine-Israeli conflict from our side. It must be because there's no reporters there. So anyway, after college, and along with my best friend who was my roommate, who also sort of wanted to be a news photographer, we bought the cheapest plane ticket from New York and we entered into Lebanon. It was Thanksgiving 1981.
I bumped into someone who was like the business manager of United Press International, and he said, we need someone. And I started doing the night shift at UPI, which is an American news agency. And then at the end of 79, I decided to go see if I wanted to do a PhD. And in a way, it was like tearing myself away from something that I really loved, you know. Anyway, so I went to this snowbound place, Madison, Wisconsin, and I did one semester, and I did really well. I had 3 A's. They offered me a full scholarship, but I was chafing to come back and be a journalist. I told my dad, you know, I have paid my way for this doctoral program. I'm coming home.
I was a photographer at the time for Reuters, and they came in and told us that the Reuters girls in Lebanon, because the whole Reuters office was mainly girls, are really tired. They can't take this anymore, so they need to go out on R&R. And so the Cairo bureau would take over in Beirut for 3 months and vice versa. And so I was among the first to go. I remember arriving and someone had told me, never forget your first impression, because after your first impression, you get used to it. The story lies in the first impression. And I remember like all these billboards, each one of them felt, was I think of different militias or whatever, but I remember these billboards because it did feel a bit menacing. It felt like I entered a story. Something about Beirut was always never quite real. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's like you're entering a dark fairy tale.
I put my life on hold. We lived from story to story. That was kind of the challenge of the day. You'd wake up in the morning, what's going on? And we all walked around with these transistor radios to our ears to know what the hell was going on, where a battle was breaking out.
We went down to Beirut and we just started walking the streets looking for news pictures. I thought, how do you become a news photographer? You have to do it. So we started walking towards the sound, towards the Green Line. And I was thinking, you know, as it gets dangerous, we won't see people on the street because they'll know to stay inside. But what I didn't realize is by 1981, people were so used to the war adi, you know. If you don't see the guy with the gun or the bullets aren't binging on the wall behind you, you go about your business. So we walked right into like a firefight on the Green Line. And so a bunch of the kids from the neighborhood, they sort of put their, you know, guns in our chest and they said, you know, what are you doing here? Why are you taking photos? And so I explained, listen, I'm a journalist. I want to photograph the war. You know, I'm Lebanese. I've come from America, blah, 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 blah. They're actually younger than me. I'm like 20 at that time. These kids are like 17, 18, 19. So they said, yalla, let's go. Anyway, so we went with them, you know, along the Green Line, and they were just sort of firing randomly, but it was very exciting to me. I had never seen anybody shoot a real gun in real life before. Anyway, we took a bunch of pictures and we walked back and we went to the Commodore. And again, we didn't really know how the news business worked. And we had the name of a photo agency in New York. So we asked, you know, how do you send a package to New York from here? And they said, well, it costs $75. Like, I only had $75. That's all I had. And we saw the Associated Press had a office across the street. So we walked up the stairs and knocked on the door and said, you know, hi, we have some photographs we'd like to show you. So they took the film from us. They introduced us to the photo bureau chief. And he said, okay, come back in half an hour and we'll see what we have. Go have a drink at the Commodore. I looked at each other. Neither one of us could afford a drink at the Commodore. Are you like kidding? We were like living on a dollar a day. So we just walked around the block for half an hour and waited, and we came back and they had 6 pictures laid out, which was unusual. And they said, we're going to buy these as a package, which we rarely do, but these are really interesting. And they said, this is how you write a caption. This is how you do it. And we're going to send these out, and they're going to be in newspapers around the world tomorrow morning. I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. And they gave us they would give us $60 for each picture. But I think for the package, they gave us like $150, which was, a lot of money to us then. So they said, the bureau chief wants to see you, go see him. So we go inside, and there's like this American guy, looked like a real, like the stereotypical cigar chomping, hard bitten newsman. And he says, okay guys, these are okay, these are pretty good. So I'm gonna explain to you how this works. We're in Lebanon. So the story here is the war. That's the super story. Now we'll have sub stories, right? The sub story might be, this battle or that battle, but because the story is the war, you need something that visually represents war in your pictures all the time. And what's the best thing? A gun. So try to have guns in your picture. So okay, guns, check. And he said, now there's different categories of gun pictures. Somebody holding the gun is okay, but it's boring. Much better to have them firing the gun. Okay. Also, if you have a regular militiaman firing the gun, that's one thing. But if you have a child firing the gun, that is 10 times better. So look for kids firing guns. They said, okay. He said, but if you ever see a woman firing a gun and you get a photograph of that, it'll be on the front pages around the world tomorrow, I guarantee it. So here's one roll of film, 36 exposures, here's like $60, and come back when you have something. In the news business, they call them bang bang pictures. So essentially what we did, actually all the news photographers, is you looked for the most spectacular or cinematic bang bang pictures that you could find. And because our psyches are all formed in some way by Hollywood and by cinema, that's kind of the standard. But things don't look like cinema in real life.
To navigate a new city in normal times is one thing, and to navigate Beirut that has no street names, that is completely upside down, and you need to go from point A to point B. I had a lot to figure out because there were 16 different militias, so not only did I have to understand who's who and who likes who and who's married to who and who's killing who, but yet they're friends. It was absolute madness. So wake up in the morning, figure out what Jumblat had said, because then that means that the movements would probably be like this. There were 3-4 people that you needed to know what they said yesterday to understand the configuration of the city, huh? Where you go, where you don't go, where don't have a Palestinian keffiyeh on you, where you should have a Palestinian keffiyeh with you. And then, number one, go to Bahsali and get a kaka with knefe. And then it really was about this network of who lives where. Huh? So there were some friends in East Beirut, and there was the West Beirut crowd, but living in different areas. So you kind of tried to connect with one or two people to kind of get an idea of the city. Huh? And then, of course, for me at the beginning, I go to the office, hopping around all the different newsrooms. And by noon, you kind of figured out where you need to be. And off you go.
The biggest challenge was knowing what was going on, knowing where you could physically go to get interviews and color and material for a story. And then there was the challenge at the end of the day of getting the story out. I used to file my stories from the Reuters office, where you had operators who would punch yellow tape. Have you ever seen the yellow telex tape with the holes in it? Yeah. I would type my story, hand it in to one of 6 or 7 operators, And that's how the stories went out. And I'd have to sit around and wait to see if the Post had questions, if they were looking for some elucidation or clarification. And I rarely came home before 1 or 2 in the morning. And there would be Shelley.
All the bureaus were located in West Beirut, as I said. I mean, the big bureaus. On the other side, it was more contained. I mean, easier to cover. In West Beirut, you had all kinds of militias and the Palestinian camps and the Syrians. I mean, the Syrians were not in East Beirut. The hostage taking, the hostage release, everything that interested the foreign media used to take place in West Beirut. We had stringers in East Beirut.
Few people could go back and forth. I was able to do that. It was sort of an advantage for me not being from here. Because I was familiar enough that I sort of looked like people they knew, but I was also foreign enough that I wasn't tied to being from this area or from that area. I was able to go with all the different groups. But I got instructions the first time I went to work for a French photo agency, Agence Gamma. And like, Gamma would have its star photographers come to Beirut. And this guy says to me, "So now you're Agence Gamma photographer, you know, you have to send us pictures all the time and we sell them. Then listen, you know, I'm gonna give you some tips. Fire makes every picture better." Which is true, fire makes every picture better. "Sometimes there's nothing happening, so if you have to pay a few kids to take a tire and light it on fire, do it for the picture." I'm like, what the fuck? I'm thinking, like, what the fuck? This is like exactly what a photographer should not do. And that was like the code of some of them. It's not called the news business for nothing, right? And if you get a picture that's on the cover of Paris Match, it's a lot of money. And people made a lot of money here. I didn't. But some people made a lot of money. And they were tuned into the economics and the economy of it, and especially the economy of publications like Paris Match, et cetera. And during the hostage situation or the hijacking situation with a TWA plane, the photographers were yelling at the kidnappers like, you know, "Put the gun to his head and stick it out of the window. No, we can't see it. It's not far enough." You know, it really did happen here. I mean, it's like the old story of the journalist covering, you know, the African wars, and they came to a room full of refugees, and somebody stood up on a table and said, "Has anyone here been raped and speaks English?"
There were these moments where how on earth you got out of there, Allah alam.
When you leave the door as a photojournalist in wartime, it's not over-dramatizing it to say you're really not sure if the person's going to come back. I mean, that's part of the deal. That's what you sign up for. In any situation where it's really dangerous and you escape with your life, in the end, it's kind of thrilling. And journalists can get caught up in that, you know, in the adrenaline of war.
Once you've been threatened by all sides, you say, okay, I think I'm doing my job here.
There were the being careful ones, and there were the crazy ones. Some of the reporters you really did feel were on a suicide mission. They didn't really care, didn't think. And I didn't think that was what was gonna get the news out.
We always strive to be there as it's happening and to be at the front of the front line. So people have to feel comfortable enough to take you under their wing, because basically you're under the protection of the killers that you're with. And if they like you, then they'll protect you and you become one like them. And so I was always pretty good at doing that. I'm not a particularly brave person by nature, and I do get scared. But when you have a sense of mission, it really makes a big difference.
If I was a conscious being, I wouldn't have done 90% of what I was doing. It's just that you were young, and I think we honestly believed that the story needed to come out, at least I did, and you felt invincible, huh? But the danger, I think you kind of acquire a survival mode, whether you like it or not, it just happens. Your body tells you, ooh, this feels weird, get out of here quick. I can't tell you how you acquire a survival mode, but you certainly do. And trust me, you keep it till the end of your days. Until today, I have reactions that are pure Beirut style, okay? I never sit with my back to a door until today. I have to see the exit. It's unconscious, but I need a way out. These survival mechanisms that I don't even realize until today that this is part of what I needed to survive.
Usually we use Lebanon Taxi, which was around the corner from Nahar. And they had drivers that knew their way around. I didn't have enough money for one of those, so I just flagged a taxi off the street. And so this driver drives right into a checkpoint. And the guys at the checkpoint ask for our passports. And when they see my little blue passport, they just go crazy. And they pull the driver out of the front seat. You know, they're shouting at him, you know, you're a spy, you're driving a spy. And I'm sitting in the back seat and I see through the windshield, I see his face just going boof, boof, poof, as they take him by the back of the head and they like are banging his face up against the windshield. And they throw him to the side and they pull me out of the car and they push me in another car. And there's one guy with a flashing to my right, one to my left. There's another guy with a gun in the passenger seat and the driver. And we start driving deeper and deeper and deeper into Dahiyeh. I'm thinking, this is not good. This is really not good. And we're going like deeper and deeper and deeper into it. Finally get to a checkpoint and the guy says, this is a closed military area, you can't enter. And the driver rolls down his window and whispers in his ear, shh, 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 shh. And the guard's face just went blank and his jaw dropped and he just nodded a little bit and he said, okay, go on, go on. And I realized they're taking me someplace to shoot me. And we get to an empty lot and there's a small knot of militiamen standing around and there's a guy in a wheelchair and he's got both legs missing and a red beret and a machine gun across his lap. And you could tell from his eyes, he's mad. And so they pushed me towards the guy and I said, listen, you know, I have a press pass from Harakat Amal, you know, I'm well known to your organization, da 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 da. And he's like, shut up, you spy. And I'm not a spy, you know, my soul is clean. If you shoot me, I'm going, shut the fuck up, turn around and run. I said, I'm not gonna turn around and run. And he said, turn around and run. And he clicks his gun. And so I turned around really slowly and I hear the gun go and I spun around and the guy next to him had taken the machine gun and had slapped it away so the bullets are sort of going everywhere and he says, no, let's take him to headquarters and then we'll shoot him. So they dragged me away and they put me in the car and we sped off and we went to the Amal headquarters and they're dragging me down the hallway by my collar and you see this guy who's the head of press for Amal and he goes, George, how do you know these guys? How do you guys know George? And they got this sheepish look on their face and they go, you know him? Yeah, I know him, he's okay. They kind of dusted me off and they said, listen, we're really, really sorry. You know, these times are tense. We have to be careful, a lot of spies around. I said, thank you. You're coming home with us. My wife makes an incredible chicken. And I'm just like, thank you very much, sir, but I think I want to go home now. And the guy looks at me and he says, listen, it was a big understanding, but now we know each other. If anybody bothers you in this town, I mean, if anybody looks at you the wrong way, you just call me. This is my number. We'll straighten them out for you. I said, okay, thank you. I think I'm going now.
Most days there was, you know, some kind of attack or assassination attempt or whatever it might be, things being blown up. So we were covering all that and the Syrians weren't at all happy and they were putting pressure on journalists here. There was one from a French newspaper who was kind of pressured into leaving the country or threatened out. Then Bernd de Boussin, who I'd been working closely with, got shot in the back by guys who'd been waiting in a car. He survived, alhamdulillah. We agreed, we had a meeting as a press corps, and we agreed that people should not do scoops out of here. In other words, if you've got some exciting information, you either pool it so everybody runs it and they can't really get rid of everybody's herd immunity, as they call it. Or you send information to your headquarters in London or wherever and publish it there, saying travelers from Damascus say this or that, you know. So we kind of agreed that, but one or two colleagues broke the rules and they found out that there'd been an assassination attempt on Hafez Assad. It's one in the newspaper, one on the BBC. So when I heard that news broadcast, I thought, that's not good. And sure enough, a few days later, I got a message through the British Embassy, who'd had a message given to them in Damascus that I'd better make myself scarce because I would get the same treatment. So I had to leave in a bit of a hurry. I went to Cyprus. It took several days because the airport was closed, so I had a slightly nervous time for several days. I remember I was living in Ayn Marais at the time, walking up the street and seeing a guy on the other side of the street who started walking, crossing the street towards me with his hand in his pocket. And I thought, uh-oh, is this it? You know, it wasn't, thank goodness. So it was a slightly nervous time because, you know, this was not jokey stuff. But it's very hard when you've got a threat like that because, of course, it's deniable. If you ask them, are you threatening my life? They say, no. And you never quite know if you're still on the list or not. You know, I know I've still got a big dusty file.
The foreigners were targeted. They all relocated to Cyprus, UPI, Reuters, AFP, and AP. Or they moved to the east side, East Beirut. The Lebanese ended up running the show here.
There were moments where I was the only one who could really go alongside the local reporters. And among the international reporters, there were not that many Arabic speakers. So they'd send me to these places that the others shouldn't go to. And you got to remember, I was like 22 or something, and no one was going to kidnap an Egyptian. No one's going to claim me, so they're not going to kidnap me. It didn't make it any less scary, but that's where I started meeting the local journalists. And it's a completely different ballgame. They had none of the privileges we had. They had none of the information we had.
84 to 89 they were very rocky times. But it was a very well-oiled machine. We would get these communiques, sometimes with pictures of the hostages holding up newspapers or with videos of the hostages begging for their governments to intervene. And there would be demands by the hostage takers. You know, you're giving arms to Iraq, or we want these prisoners in Kuwait to be released. But there would be diatribes against weapons sales by the French and the British and the Americans to Iraq. The people who took the hostages would go around and shop for the best deal to sell their hostages. They would do a little research, you know, who did what. Then they would sell them from group to group, and they'd end up with the master group that would send us these written communiques with the list of demands. And some hostages were killed.
Whenever they want to send a message, they would drop a video cassette or a letter at the reception, and we would publish it. When they used to send these video cassettes of the French hostages, they would send it to the AFP, for example. Terry Anderson to Al-Nahar, where UPI is, or to AP, the British to Reuters, depends. Who wants to break the news the first? I mean, there was tough competition between the four big news agencies. It was crazy, you know, everyone rushing to get the video and to break the news, and because the hostages would send messages on behalf of the abductors. You have to pressure Israel to free, I don't know who, in order for us to be released or something. The messages were sent through the hostages.
There was a pub called Backstreet. Two friends of mine were drinking there. This was in 86. They were having a drink there, and they were on their way home. They got picked up, sold on. This was when America was bombing Libya. Sold on to a Libyan group, and they were murdered, you know. Philip Padfield and Lee Douglas. One was an English language teacher. They were good friends. I mean, good friends. I went to their funerals in London, you know. Their murder was particularly bad because they were just very nice people. They were gay, but not a gay couple. That probably had nothing to do with it. But they were just really nice, gentle people. And I still feel the loss. And Philip wrote poetry, which was published later on and so on. But that's the kind of thing that touches you very deeply. And his friends still talk about and remember him, though that was now, what, how many years? 34 years ago or something, you know. But we had a lot of fun, you know, we'd go out drinking and sitting around chatting and bullshitting and stuff. So, yeah, it wasn't all beer and Skittles, as my German teacher used to say.
There's a party at Rida Slams. Do you want to go? You know, when it's your first day in Beirut and it's, as they used to call it, war-torn, mainly Muslim West Beirut. Night number one, you want to go to this party? He's like, sure. So I go to the party and it's this amazing house. Everybody dressed to kill. And it was just party time. And so I guess this schizophrenia of what you do in the morning and then what you do at night started on day one. Used to call it Sniper Alley, Tur al-Mur. And so you didn't really go there willingly, but if you were in Sniper Alley itself, technically it was less dangerous. Because nobody was sniping down to the street. Huh? And so we'd go have picnics on Sniper Alley. I was just talking about suicide missions, but it felt okay. Anyway, so Aline and I would nifrish, we'd put like this little blanket. Aline is a magnificent cook. Huh? So she'd bring all the food and we'd sit on Sniper Alley with our breakfast. And I actually have a picture somewhere with Aline, myself, one of the snipers from the east and another sniper from the west, all eating, and just the barbed wire behind us, there's El Ghem, mines. So we'd sit there and just wait, and on several occasions, the snipers from right and from left would come and eat with us. Maybe my memory fails me, but it was kind of relaxed. I mean, it's the weirdest pronoun to use in this context, but it was kind of relaxed. Yes, you're sitting in a war zone. Yes, you're in the middle of the green line. Yes, right behind you it says mines. But it was quite relaxed. And, you know, you'd sit around for hours and just chat. They kind of, obviously, in a way, it was part of our work. Because then they'd tell you what happened. Then you'd get tidbits of information you wouldn't get otherwise.
One of the things about Beirut really is that people do enjoy themselves, even if times are hard. You know, Lebanese got this amazing ability to, you know, sing and dance at parties and things, even if bombs are falling. So yeah, people found ways of doing stuff. There were concerts, Christmas concerts, that kind of stuff. That sort of kept going somehow, you know, even in bad times.
My experience comparing, say, Palestine under siege to Lebanon under siege, so that the reactions of the locals are wildly different. In the Ramallah, in bad times, if there is a bar open, it has happened that, you know, people drive by and like throw a hand grenade at the building. You know, here, if there's a bar open during a shelling, it's like, let's park the car and let's go inside.
The sound of an incoming missile and an outgoing missile are very different. And I don't know if it's your brain or your body or your ears, something kind of tunes in to know whether it's incoming and or outgoing. And when it's outgoing, you just don't hear it anymore. It's just part of daily life. And then the sound changes and you duck.
That's what people like to call resilience, which has become a bad word in Lebanon, because we feel that our resilience has replaced the government's willingness to do what it's supposed to do. Because, you know, we run our own water supply, our own power supply, our own everything. It's like every household is a government unto itself, with its own ministries administering the shortcomings and the ineptitude of what should be government-provided services. Kind of how a society is dismembered and is on its knees, yet it finds ways to keep going day to day.
Especially in the South. And it's like, hold on, guys. Like, it's not over. What are you building already? There was this constant destruction and construction, destruction and construction. And I think that's how they survive. And in many ways, I find it much more healthy than anywhere else.
Emotions back then were bottled up. You have to bottle yourself up, because you can't deal with all this. I mean, this horror. Even like the little horrors in Beirut would send people to a psychiatrist in most countries in a normal situation. And to me, the Lebanese way of dealing with trauma is special and unique. I don't care what anyone says. Not resilient, not resilient, not resilient. Yeah, like, us Dao protest too much. We are the most resilient people in the world, and that is our strength. Sorry, that's our pride. You know, and the Lebanese reaction is different. It's irrepressible. It's beautiful. It is beautiful. Painful, and it's full of sorrow. And I guess that's why I love living here, because everyone here carries sorrow. Everyone here carries tragedy.
We always found a way to kind of recover short term. There'd be 1 or 2 days of respite or a truce. Someone would have a party and we'd dance until we dropped, or that's how you kind of kept going.
The major decision was, do I go home, take a shower, or do I go to the back street? So, of course, I was amongst those, like, forget the shower. We'll do it tomorrow morning. Because if you decided to go into the back street, it meant that at 10 o'clock, the doors are gonna close, and you ain't getting out of there until 6 in the morning. And practically every night, you had an entire crowd that decided to just stay in the back street. Lena and myself were amongst the dancers of the back street. And I think it was amazing, because you're in this enclosed bubble with people who know exactly what space you're in. And I think that's another very fine distinction. We were all journalists amongst each other. We were living the same reality. And each one of us had to deal with all of this in their own way. And being locked in this club that had great music, and just all of us venting, knowing it was a safe space. And so whenever I sort of think back on these moments, yeah, it was the best time of my life. You went to the back street and you knew that you're gonna be with friends and be in a safe space when the whole world outside felt very much like an unsafe space.